Okay, Brendan, we're definitely not recording right now, right?
No,
that's good because last night, you know, I tried to listen to a woman. She wouldn't let me, but yeah. I respected the hell out of her for sure.
Yeah, man. Sometimes when you're a well-known podcaster, you can just walk up to a woman and you can amplify her voice. You don't even have to ask. You can just do it.
You could come over here and give Will a little hug.
Oh, man. I'm glad we're not recording. Yeah, we definitely should start recording. I mean, I'm just glad there's, you know, no audio of this. No one ever's going to find it, thank God. All right, it's Chapo for the week. In a little bit, we'll be talking to Chase Madar about the uses and abuses of human rights law and the institutions that govern them. That is, you know, your vegetables. That was a serious, informative, intelligent interview. And then I think for the rest of the show, we're just going to talk about Trump grabbing people's pussies. Yeah, does that sound okay?
It's what you want to hear about. It's what we want to talk about. It's the only thing that makes sense.
Whom amongst us has not tried to impress Billy Bush? You know, I think the big bombshell in these revelations is that Trump has possibly never had sex because he's like, oh my God, I'm with alpha male Billy Bush. How do I impress him? Oh my God. You know, Billy, when I see women, I cannot stop kissing them. And sometimes I even take them furniture shopping.
I totally understand it, though. It reminds me of the time that I really wanted to impress Mark McGrath. So I confessed to a murder.
I just want to die. All right. One other subjective note. We are recording in my apartment today, and we also have a silent guest from the media who's sitting in.
The MSM. parenthesis media. Other parenthesis.
Colette, say something.
Hi.
Okay, you're implicated in this show just as much as we are right now.
You're going down with us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
we say.
It's a little something called strategy.
Yeah.
All right, let's start the show. Chapo, let's go. We are here with Chase Madar to talk about a topic he's written about before, but just the general kind of imperial drift and weaponization of sort of the human rights institutions and clerisy. But before we get into that, I would just like to apologize. Felix cannot be with us here for this interview. He woke up this morning and heard the Donald Trump audio for the first time and quite frankly was so ashamed and disgusted on behalf of men everywhere that he made himself physically ill. And can't be here. So I apologize for that.
He told me he was giving out free hugs in family court. You know, he had the big sign and everything.
No, he likes to pretend he has a more charitable behavior than he does. But Chase, thanks for being here. Good for you, actually, because you're following up on what has universally been regarded as our best episode and guest ever. So no pressure. Yeah, so thanks for being here, like I said. So by way of sort of like a getting into this topic, I want to talk about what just happened in Colombia. And like I'm hoping that you can explain to me and our listeners just what went down in terms of like there was a proposed peace deal that would have ended their 50 plus year civil war. It seemed like it was going to happen and then it didn't. Could you explain to us what went down and how the sort of human rights industry played into that?
Surely. First, thanks so much for having me in your lovely trap home. It's really a gas. Colombia just had a plebiscite last Sunday, October 2nd, a national vote to get political approval for a peace deal with a very large guerrilla movement called the FARC, the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia.
By the way, Chase is a Spanish.
Sorry,
accent,
I'm a Spanish
so
speaker.
On point, super on point. You're a translator. You do this for a living.
I have translated. I apologize for speaking every Spanish name
say,
like
just
that.
Just say Nicaragua.
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 Nicaragua. I'm gonna, so, I'm just gonna so you know, you, I'm gonna take you to my neighborhood Mexican restaurant and have you order from now on.
Oh God, I'm that kind of annoying gringo. I want everyone to know that just from the outset. But so Colombia has this vote to ratify this peace deal with the FARC, this radical guerrilla movement that has been very strong in its 50 years in time. Its strength has ebbed and it's grown and ebbed again. It's controlled big parts of the country, its territory. They tried to go legit and integrate into the political process with an earlier deal in the 80s and form a political party, La Unión Patriótica. There I go again. And most of their candidates, hundreds of them, were gunned down and just murdered.
By what, paramilitary groups?
By right-wing paramilitary groups. I mean, they were just not allowed in. But there's been a long in-the-making peace deal with the FARC between the Colombian state and the FARC. It's been negotiated in Havana and without much intervention from the United States or from the UN. But Havana and the Cuban government has been kind of the host for this process. And everyone expected this peace vote ratification to sail through last Sunday. And it did not. It was defeated, surprisingly, very narrowly, by less than 1 point, 49.78% voted yes for peace. But
so this is a national referendum in Colombia.
It's a national referendum.
Go or no go on this peace deal with the FARC, right? Yeah. And it lost by about 1 percentage point.
Why the hell do you put that shit up for a fucking popular vote?
There's been a lot of second thoughts about plebiscites this year after Brexit and now with this. But it lost by a difference of about 54,000 votes. Turnout was only 37% out of 34 million eligible voters. And
I blame millennials.
thank you. we're going to be saying that throughout the segment. And the peace deal, it had been supported by every major Colombian human rights group. It was supported by the Colombian government, and it was even supported by the U.S. State Department. I mean, how often do you see that? Against the peace deal is the thuggy side of Colombia. There's former hardline president Álvaro Uribe, who's very much on the same page with right-wing paramilitaries. You have Pablo Escobar's former chief hitman, John Jairo Velasquez, a.k.a. Popeye. And you also have Human Rights Watch.
What? Record Squatch. Okay. Yes.
So
this is where we get into it. What was Human Rights Watch getting invested in this? And particularly the head of the Human Rights Watch, they were speaking out quite vociferously against this deal.
Yeah, so why is Human Rights Watch not exactly on the side of the angels opposing this long-in-the-making peace deal?
I mean, that would
end
a
52-year civil war. I guess they determined from the 34th floor of the Empire State Building, where they are based, that this peace deal did not meet their rigorous legal standards of what a peace deal should look like.
Well-known fact that Human Rights Watch, you say they're on the 34th floor of the Empire State Building?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're down the hall from the Anthony Cumia Studios. Oh, that's at the top of the Empire State Building. You're right. Okay. Same building, though.
So their head of their Americas department, Jose Miguel Vivanco, had been, you know, ragging on and, you know, inveighing against this peace deal for several months, calling it una piñata de impunidad, a piñata of impunity. Because this peace deal, like so many other transitional deals, grants a high degree of impunity to people who have committed some horrible crimes on both sides, in the FARC and also in the Colombian military and paramilitary groups. And, you know, the impunity is bitter. It's awful. But it's also been, to one degree or another, essential to pretty much every kind of peace deal that you've had to end civil wars or to have a transition from an authoritarian government to a more democratic one. And this is how it worked in South Africa. with the fall of apartheid, how it worked in Spain after the death of Franco, and in Chile and Argentina when they transitioned to democracy after military dictatorships. So you had something along that lines of transitional justice here, but not to the rigorous standards of Human Rights Watch from the 34th floor of the Empire State Building. And Jose Miguel Vivanco, the head of Human Rights Watch's Americas division, even threatened to call in the International Criminal Court at The Hague. He thought that they should get involved and investigate war crimes if this so-called peace deal worked too.
So basically, they were concerned that FARC was going to get off too easy.
Yeah, and they would hasten to say also the military.
Also they're the both
sides.
Yeah.
And both sides did do horrible things. There's no doubt about that. But there's also such a thing as political reality. And it's very telling that every province of Colombia that was hit especially hard by this long-going civil war voted very strongly in favor of the peace deal. It was the cities and the parts of the country that had not been affected by the peace deal where they voted against it.
All right, so what do you think is the motivating factor here? Why would Human Rights Watch, an organization like that, why would they insert themselves into this political dispute? Why would they come out so against this deal? What do you think is behind it?
Yeah, I mean, why would they? I mean, it was really striking. Ken Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch since 1993, he was positively gloating about the failure of this peace deal to be ratified. And on Twitter, he snarkily tweeted, "Looks like Colombians aren't so eager to premise, quote, peace on effective impunity for FARC's and military's war crimes," putting peace in quotation marks. I mean, I guess that's easy to do from the 34th floor of the Empire State Building, but again,
where's that location again? Yeah.
every part of Colombia that was hit especially hard by this long raging civil war voted for the peace deal. I guess they lacked the kind of Yale law education that many in Human Rights Watch have. So why did they do this? Many people are asking that.
It seems like a real letter of the law rather than spirit issue here when it comes to human rights and things like that.
You know, that's definitely a large part of it. I think there's a lot of political blindness. Many lawyers in general, and particularly in international law, that's a very big church, but people have very widely varying degrees of political awareness and sophistication. And they think that often that the world is just revolving around laws and that law is truly what's governing things rather than politics and power. And many people were surprised by human rights' standard. I mean, isn't human rights supposed to be, you know, all these nice things and not, you know, going against a peace deal that would end a 52-year civil war in Colombia? Many people were surprised, but not me, because as you noted in your introduction, I've been writing about the creeping weaponization of the human rights industry, its institutions, its grandees, even its doctrines for, you know, since 2009. This isn't the first time that Human Rights Watch has plumped for war. It's the first time they've gone explicitly against a peace deal, which is shocking and really quite despicable, I think. But they also supported the Somalia intervention of the U.S. in 1992, which did not end well. They were all for bombing Belgrade over Kosovo in 1999, which many people remember as a, you know, uncontroversial success. But there are plenty of scholars of that who see that it resulted in the ethnic cleansing of Kosovo, of ethnic Serbs and other minorities, and that a political solution really could have been worked with a little more patience, a little more resourcefulness. They supported the Libya war in 2011. And just days after the airstrikes began against the Gaddafi government, one Human Rights Watch researcher called Karine Dufka called for, quote, "nothing less than the type of unified and decisive action the UN Security Council has brought to bear in Libya on the Ivory Coast on Côte d'Ivoire. So even it looks very much like calling for some kind of multilateral warfare being waged to deal with the crisis of stability in Côte d'Ivoire.
I want to read from you here. This is from something you wrote in the London Review of Books about this. And you say, just sort of about this kind of legal clerisy and institutions of human rights. You say, many humanitarian lawyers seem to have persuaded themselves that war can be conducted with clinical precision given the advances in both military technology and the laws that govern how war should be fought. But the casualty figures and consequences of recent wars argue otherwise, and it seems the real function is less a restraint on lethal force than a license and a lubricant.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds good.
Well put. But, okay, now, they're like, in preparing for this conversation is sort of one name that comes up again and again, sort of that you've written about in terms of outlining the kind of the ideology of this sort of just war and humanitarian war ideology and sort of legal doctrine is Samantha Power, who was appointed by the Obama administration. What was her position in the Obama administration?
Well, she was at first on the National Security Council. I can't remember the exact title. It was something special, something for multilateral affairs.
Okay.
And tried to develop some mechanisms in the U.S. government to, you know, act preventively against genocide. You know, not such a bad thing. But she has come out over time as one of the leading hawks in the Obama administration. She was a big supporter of the Libya war, an enthusiastic supporter of the Afghan war escalation that Obama chose to do. He had political wiggle room not to do it, but she was editorializing about how we can arm twist allies like Canada to get them to feed more troops into that.
Now, I remember back when the Libyan, you know, quote, intervention happened, when that bombing campaign happened, the actual, you know, justification for it was this idea that if we don't intervene, there will be a genocide in Benghazi, of all places. But that was the thing. They were like, you know, it's days away from happening. And it was this kind of very seductive argument was made. Like, look, we have this power for military. If we can just push this button and basically stop all these innocent people from being slaughtered by Gaddafi's state forces, wouldn't you do that? Or why wouldn't you do that? And that became, that, at least in the media, that was the most common justification given for U.S. intervention in Libya.
Yeah, it was. And I certainly don't want to minimize the reprisals that those people in Libya who had stood up against the Gaddafi government would have faced. This is something that had happened periodically under Gaddafi's rule, and there had been reprisals with death tolls in the hundreds. This time around, it was simply assumed that the death toll would be in the tens of thousands, that it would be much more enormous than ever before. And it was really France and Great Britain who were, you know, chomping at the bit to bomb and to use this as a reason to, among other things, get rid of someone who they never really liked playing with or interacting with, Gaddafi.
Yeah, they were sick of visiting him in a tent.
Yes. You know? So, but here we have 5 years later, and ISIS has set up shop. There are 4,000 to 6,000 ISIS soldiers in Libya. It's war torn. There are, you know, constantly peace deals in the, you know, hopefully in the works there, but it is not made a smooth transition to anything like a peaceful country. It's in the midst of civil war, and again, we're bombing them all over again too, without much public debate or controversy.
I mean, I think the Libyan example is an instructive one, because, you know, you mentioned, and you know, you had another article about Samantha Power in Counterpunch, and you mentioned that Samantha Power was actually against the Iraq War. I mean, not vociferously so, but she was not a supporter of it. Of course, when she came in power, it's not like she really did a lot to, you know, go against it or anything like that. But the idea is that the Libyan invasion was kind of a miniature, faster version of exactly what we did in Iraq. But it was like the sort of liberal version, because there was no ground troops, and right, it was done under the, like Iraq, for humanitarian reasons, but it was done under the idea that, well, look, we don't have to commit ground troops. It's not going to be the disaster that Iraq was. But essentially, it created the exact same conditions,
yes,
that we saw in Iraq, just quicker and with fewer U.S. casualties or no U.S. casualties.
There's chaos, and it's violent chaos there. And those who supported the Libya invasion, the way they cover their behinds now is by saying, well, it was the right thing to do. It was the smart thing to do, except for inadequate post-intervention preparations. And what that bland little phrase really means is, I mean, a full-on invasion. How many ground troops does that require to stabilize? How long does it take before there's an insurgency against that grounded invasion force, like we've seen in Iraq and like we've seen in Afghanistan? The idea, and how long are they going to have to stay? These are not afterthoughts. They were afterthoughts, and they're afterthoughts now, but they shouldn't be. They're absolutely fundamental to thinking this kind of invasion over. And the idea that the intervention was dandy, but for the violent chaos that followed, is of course ridiculous. And to think that it would have been somehow better if we had invaded yet another Middle Eastern country, and that we would not have faced a full on insurgency, fairly quickly, is also blotting out reality.
And again, this was all done under the guise of human rights and using American power to save lives or to prevent the worst disasters of the 20th century, et cetera, et cetera. And I think to get into that, I think we should talk about Samantha Power's book.
Yeah,
this book is something of a phenomenon. It's called A Problem from Hell: America and the Age of Genocide. Didn't she win the Pulitzer Prize for this book?
It wins the Pulitzer Prize.
It was widely and positively reviewed.
It's a 600-page book subtitled America and the Age of Genocide. And what's most striking about it is really what's not in this 600-page book, again, subtitled America and the Age of Genocide. And those post-war genocides that the U.S. had some kind of hand in, supplying intelligence, condoning, complicity, are airbrushed from this. The Indonesian massacre of communists and fellow travelers in 1965-66, death toll in hundreds of thousands, we don't know how many, is simply not mentioned even once in this book.
Now, as we were preparing, I mean, you said that you checked the index and the word Guatemala
is not even in the index. Okay, in fairness, East Timor, okay, this was a genocide committed by Indonesia when they invade in 1975. That gets exactly one sentence. And she even gets that sentence wrong, saying the U.S., quote, looked the other way. In fact, the U.S. was looking right at it. President Ford and Henry Kissinger spent the night in Jakarta meeting with the dictator of Indonesia, Suharto, literally the night before. And there was a kind of green light given, and they provided military training weaponry.
And this is what's so gross to me about Samantha Power, is that whenever I think of her, I think of that one photo of her and Henry Kissinger at Yankee Stadium. And she's like, she tweeted it and was like, I'm a Red Sox fan. Henry's a Yankee fan, but we come together for our love of baseball. And it's just like, wait, aren't you the lady that wrote a book about how terrible genocide is? What the fuck are you doing?
That was really a barf moment. But what I found also kind of barf-worthy was some liberal hand-wringing afterwards, saying, oh, it's so sad how Samantha Power has really compromised her values, because that book she wrote about genocide was so good. I didn't know genocide was bad till I read her book. I was, kind of on the fence. No, I mean, I think that Samantha Power's scholarly career shows an incredible lack of integrity. And to leave out the genocides that her country and my country had a hand in is borders on genocide denial. I mean, what would we think if a Polish intellectual wrote a 600-page book subtitled Poland and the Age of Genocide, and then just somehow forgot to mention those death camps that were set up with some complicity of Polish people in Poland.
Has she ever been confronted with this? Or has anyone, has she ever been asked or in a review or anything? Has she ever address the issue of why she didn't talk about all the genocides that the United States actually participated in.
I think I caught a glimmer of that once on the internet, and she fobbed it off with some excuse so mealy-mouthed that I refuse to remember it. But again, look,
you guys are being very judgmental. You guys need to remember you can't condemn a genocide until you've tried one. High and mighty, and tell me that they're bad.
We should really look at both sides.
Yeah.
No, I mean,
and the fact that the judges in her Pulitzer committee didn't have a problem with this speaks volumes. I mean, the book came out in 2003. There's a real need for American intellectuals to feel good about themselves, to feel like team players with the Iraq invasion having just been underway. And the idea that, well, we can, you know, stop genocides is, I guess, that overrode any kind of historical memory, if, you know, assuming the judges even had that. But, you know, needless to say, sins of commission are worse than sins of omission in every moral code, whether it's, you know, the Babylonian Talmud or the Nebraska criminal code. And the idea that you can airbrush from the historical record those genocides where the U.S. had some kind of supportive or active role of complicity and not even mention them is just, again, a staggering lack of intellectual integrity.
Well, you talk about how her career and this ideology was sort of shaped by her experiences as a reporter in Bosnia, but like also it's the idea of Bosnia and Rwanda are held up as like these two examples in the 90s of like where the U.S. did nothing. And I got, you know, I mean, it's a very seductive idea, and it does have power to it. Mm-hmm. Like this idea that, well, the United States is the most powerful country in the world. You know, we let the Holocaust happen in World War II. We should have done more to stop that. Never again. How can we let these atrocities continue to happen in the world if we have the power to stop them?
Yeah, I mean, I want us to speak to that head on, too, because that's a reasonable question. There's a Rwanda and Great Lakes of Africa regional specialist who died in an airplane crash a few years ago, who was also involved with Human Rights Watch, named Alison DeForge, DeForges, who came up with a very handy 10-point guide to how to prevent genocides, what the U.S. and other powerful, wealthy states can do to prevent genocides. And, you know, armed intervention does make the list as the absolute last resort at number 10. But the first 9 steps are diplomatic measures, flexing the power of Washington abroad, where Washington has incredible amounts of power, using economic diplomacy, cultural diplomacy, media diplomacy. And these are all kind of preventive measures that can be exercised, you know, like a good doctor recommends preventive steps rather than going for invasive surgery right away. And you find very little about these preventive measures in Samantha Power's book. It's much more about the need to use military force. And that's part of the weaponization of the human rights industry. You have a really atrophied imagination and historical knowledge of successful diplomacy. And the idea is the only kind of statecraft that means anything is making war, dropping bombs, drone strike. That's what really works. And that's a kind of crackpot realism that we see fail time and again, whether in Iraq and Libya. You know, look at those landscapes, and that's what that kind of crackpot realism will get you. Sorry, Matt, you
basically,
were about to...
I was going to say that, like, because obviously when the state decides it's going to intervene somewhere, this human rights shit is just a very helpful bit of propaganda to justify it. The people making these decisions are doing so out of, you know, bloody, cold-blooded realpolitik. But I think for the people who take this shit seriously, the powers and the acolytes, these human rights hawks, I think it's sort of a geopolitical version of those people who comment on stories on Facebook, like local news stories about child molesters or something, who go like, if I fucking got that guy, I would fucking crush his face. I would fucking put him in a fucking microwave. I would grind him up in a fucking hamburger. It's like, they want to do violence, but they don't want to like feel bad about it, so they direct all that violent fantasy onto a bad guy.
And
these are
Coney.
People who, for whatever reason, they want they want the thrill of those fucking F-16s flying through the air and the and the soul-rattling rumble of those bombs going off, but they don't want to feel bad about it. They don't want to feel like warmongers. So if there's just some fucking piece of shit that they could blow up, then it's okay.
Chase, I want to come back to something you said earlier about the idea that for a lot of lawyers and people who are like very, very technical about the law, and especially when it comes to this sort of just war idea and human rights law, they think that it's this kind of pedantry that emerges where it's just like you said that they think that law is really what governs the world and not politics and power. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, there's this professional vanity that, you know, most professions have. If you go to a medical conference, you think that the world revolves around orthopedic surgery, or, you know, that all the world's problems would be solved if we only had more, nephrologists around, you know, so people's kidneys. You have that in spades with lawyers, and especially when it comes to war. I mean, law is a prestige profession. There are a lot of smart people teaching at law schools and going to law schools. But this idea that when it comes to matters of war, that lawyers are sitting at the big table with the generals, with the politicians, that's really not the case usually. Lawyers provide vital services to military force, and they're much more accurately compared to the rabble of stable boys, scullery maids, and other kinds of workers who have traditionally followed armies during campaign season. And you see this especially with the laws of war, where nothing is more overhyped than the laws of war. And it really comes in two directions. You have the kind of ooga booga nationalist who thinks that we have these restrictive rules of engagement, and that's why we lost in Vietnam, that's why we're losing in Afghanistan. They're tying both our hands behind, you know, soldier little Jimmy's back.
Right.
And, you know, it's these wankers who, you know,
these wankers on the 34th floor of the Empire State Building.
Hey, that's my bit. And, this is nonsense. I mean, the laws of war exist to a large degree to facilitate military violence. And this is something that smart lawyers who follow this do, even, you know, ones who are not particularly left-wing. I mean, I had a great conversation at academic workshop with a retired Air Force Major General late last year, Charlie Dunlop, who's telling me that a lot of people forget that it's pretty difficult to make a psychologically normal soldier pull the trigger and kill another human being. And the reason why they're checking back with lawyers who are involved in the targeting process is not so much to restrain them, it's to dig in the spurs to make them do that so they feel authorized, so they can do it. And the laws of war, more than anything else, are a kind of military logistics, sort of a minor part of supply chain logistics. And yet they have this absurdly inflated importance, both from the ooga booga right and from, you know, liberal legalists who think that, oh, if we only have enough lawyers involved, then war can be this surgical humanitarian process, you know, to sterilize the instruments. What could be better than warfare with more lawyers involved? I mean, that's what we need. And you have
this is the Lionel Hutz view.
It's very much a Lionel Hutz.
Can you imagine a world without lawyers?
But it's and unfortunately, if you look at a typical news story about, say, the Saudi bombardment of Yemen right now, it very quickly degenerates in the quality media, say the New York Times or New York Review of Books, into discussion of laws. Like, well, the Saudis, are they bombing Yemen the right way? Are they using the right kind of munitions? And these questions, they mean something. I'm not saying they're irrelevant, but even if, say, the Israeli Defense Forces adhered super strictly to the laws of armed conflict the next time they, you know, assault Gaza, what's the difference in death toll going to be? About 20% less? This is not the big question. What's the difference in death toll for Yemen Or for Syria, if, say, Saudi jets who are getting refueled in air by American, military force, or Russian jets over Syria, if they are adhering super strictly to the laws of war, yeah, there are going to be fewer people killed. But I think we're talking about maybe 20% fewer. You still have the war going on. And these first order questions about whether or not the war is right in the first place, what the political alternatives are to war in the first place, those get overlooked very often and really replaced by a sterile legalistic discussion about whether or not there are enough lawyers involved in the bombing process.
Well, 20% is not nothing. It's not nothing. And I remember Chomsky said something along the lines of, it's a sign of how much we've progressed as a culture and a society in terms of like civilizing influence on American politics, is that even at the height of the Iraq War's savagery, like 2003, 2004, nobody in the Defense Department or the Bush administration could have ever dreamed of prosecuting it with the same intensity as we did in Vietnam 30 or 40 years earlier.
Yeah, but part of that is, I mean, who did we bomb indiscriminately in Vietnam? We bombed North Vietnam. There was no North Vietnam to bomb during the Iraq invasion.
That's true. Yeah.
If there had been, who knows what we would have done? I mean, it's not an apples to apples comparison.
Sorry, no.
I honestly think that American public would countenance an uncountable number of dead Arabs if we thought it was necessary.
If we had like,
I think that the reason we killed fewer Iraqis or fewer people in the Middle East in the Iraq War was just because of the array of forces. I think it had way more to do with that than it did with any kind of moral considerations. I mean, we've killed 1 million people maybe in the Middle East in the last decade, and nobody gives a fuck. If it was 2 million, would they give any more of a fuck?
Well, there you go. 2 million might might be illegal.
I don't want to just dismiss what the laws of war do entirely, but I do need to point out that there are much bigger issues and problems with the Saudi-led assault on Yemen, what Russian jets and American jets are doing in Syria, the Israeli Defense Forces, aerial assaults on Gaza, much bigger problems with those than whether or not they're bombing the correct way that, Human Rights Watch might approve of or not. And we need to really repoliticize war and the way we look at war and not let go of law entirely, but realize that war is not a matter of law fundamentally. And the quality liberal media in the U.S. just can't get enough hand-wringing about the legality of drones rather than more first-order questions like, well, how many people are being killed? And also,
Is it necessary?
I want to talk about, there are, even as tangled and difficult a problem as Syria, the questions that humanitarian lawyers and people in general should be asking aren't about, well, how do we bomb and where do we bomb and how many, which lawyers do we get to help determine where to bomb? It's first order diplomatic questions like what kind of grand bargain can Washington strike with Russia to get them to stop bombing? This could involve other things like pledge of no NATO expansion for Ukraine and Georgia, some concessions in economic ties, a pledge that Russia can keep its blue water port in Tartus in Syria, which is mainly symbolic importance, but it's something. Iran is a player in this internationalized civil war there. What if we normalized diplomatic relations with Iran? That doesn't mean we love each other. We had normalized diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. It's not a question of romance. It's just a better way to communicate with other countries when you can deal with certain political issues, face to face. Even dialogue with Hezbollah, which is a player in the Syria conflict, that would be a first step towards getting them, extricating them from this conflict too. But these aren't the kinds of things that humanitarian lawyers at the elite level are really calling for. They're not sexy. They're not kinetic. They're not explodey. It's not like the finale of a Michael Bay movie. But these are the things that can, lead to a political solution and lead to peace.
It's a problem from heck.
It's a problem from heck. Yeah. Now, one thing, I mean, the ultimate fantasy that a lot of, you know, elite human rights lawyers have is that the International Criminal Court will be able to handle all this. And you see this in Ken Roth's Twitter feed, like, oh, you know, Assad in Syria, he really needs to stand before the International Criminal Court. And I understand the sentiment. It's great. But, you know, this bullshit about the International Criminal Court, the ICC has been around for 12 years. Guess how many convictions they've had in 12 years?
How many?
Exactly 4.
Okay.
4 convictions in 12 years. I mean, and
didn't Slobodan Milosevic like die before that?
They had their own special tribunal for Yugoslavia, but this is like Santeria for people with Harvard law degrees.
This is like the stupid chief in 80s action movies that are like, Damn it, McBain! You blew up an entire factory to get at one bad guy. You know how much property damage you caused? And he's like, I get results.
Well, McGonagall, Billy is dead. They slit his throat from ear to ear.
Hey, I'm trying to eat lunch here.
My favorite thing about the Milosevic trial is that he apparently stopped taking his hypertension medicine so that he'd be like too sick for the trial to go forward. And then that literally killed him. He like owned himself. He owned himself in an effort to own the court. I think that's pretty cool. But all those other dudes, they've all been on trial for basically ever, like Karadzic and those guys. And then since it's Europe, if they do get convicted, they'll get like community service or something. They'll have to go to Sarajevo and like pick up litter in like a reflective orange vest.
I think it's important.
They probably have video games in while they're waiting too. The color TV.
It's important to be skeptical to a high degree of these international tribunals. You know, and many of them have done important work too. But the ICC in particular,
haven't all those convictions been of Africans? Yeah, haven't they like only convicted Africans?
I think we're 4 for 4 out of that.
Interesting.
You know, from sub-Saharan Africa.
How that's where they're able to throw the book and like get a guy in the dock and convict him.
And African heads of state are really not happy about this. They see this as just an international court with pretensions of a global purview, but it's just aimed at sub-Saharan Africa. But to think that this is going to solve their problems, it's like the rapture for Ivy League NGO lawyers. It has to be seen for what it is. And I know that people have dreams and hopes invested in it. But when we're talking about solutions to civil wars and horrible political crises with mass death, we need to, you know, care about much more than the dreams of, you know, aspiring NGO lawyers.
Which brings
I think
back.
At a certain point, people are just like, people are driven insane in the United States specifically by just how much military power they imagine we have, because it is the most powerful military force in human history. And so people want to imagine it being put to good use, and then they see any kind of violence and then they assume basically that it happens. It's like Superman. Like if somebody dies under Superman's watch, then it's his fault because he could have stopped it. And that's us. But then we see how little that power actually means anything when it confronts reality. And, of course, that's never put into it. And really, the thing that I always come back to is the lesson to this is not, well, we need to figure out a better way to, you know, be powerful and a better way to project our power. It's that no fucking country should have that much power in the first place.
And, you know, back to Colombia and this, at least for now, dead peace deal, you know, like to the Samantha Powers of the world, like there's, you know, like the military solution to atrocities and things like that. But as you pointed out in the most obvious critique of her book, if the United States was interested in ending all of these hells on Earth, it would never have gotten involved in the first place, or at least it wouldn't have supported all these nasty right-wing governments in Central and South America specifically, and then the rest of the world as well. Because, look, whether it's FARC or the Sandinistas or whatever, all these dirty wars, look, they're bad, they're dirty, both sides, you know, Ron Fournier, both sides do terrible shit. But, if you weigh out the scale, it's not even at all. I mean, in terms of like the actual genocides being carried out are almost all by clients of the United States who are all nasty right-wing psychopaths, basically.
Yeah, and you would expect humanitarian lawyers to be at the forefront of demanding, you know, preventive diplomatic measures to prevent U.S. policy from fueling these atrocities to begin with. Instead, you have someone like Harold Koh, okay, former dean of Yale Law School, pioneering human rights scholar. He's the guy who came up with the legal rationale for Obama's drone strikes, and he proudly unveiled it at a meeting of the American Society for International Law in the basement of the Washington, D.C. Ritz-Carlton, and got warm applause when he talked about the nice human rightsy reasons we're going to be using these aerial death robots to assassinate people. And he earnestly believed it, maybe not fully aware that he was being used as kind of a human rights hood ornament on these Stinger missiles, as a kind of high-end window dressing. And that's certainly how other people in government saw it. I want to read just a really short snatch from an inside journalist account by Daniel Kleidman of the drone strikes and the role of Harold Koh's human rights prestige for securing a rationale for drone strikes. Harold Koh began lobbying Secretary Clinton and the White House to let him make a speech in defense of targeted killing. The White House saw an upside in making him the unlikely public face of the CIA's drone program. It was a Nixon goes to China play. God, I hate that phrase. It would give the president cover with both the human rights community and America's allies. The military and the CIA, too, loved the idea. They called the State Department lawyer, quote, Killer Koh behind his back. Some of the drone operators, even talked about printing up T-shirts that said, quote, drones. If they're good enough for Harold Koh, they're good enough for me. So this is the role of human rights grandees in American war policy. Just a nice little hood ornament.
Well, it seems like they're more than happy to be a hood ornament as long as they're shiny.
I think these people, they just get a little snort of Washington power up their nose and they go loco. They go crazy.
I need more, man. I saw what's it, Brzezinski, father of Mika, the other day saying...
Solid man.
Yeah, in Obama's last month's
office. That guy's the low-T Kissinger.
He said Obama in his last month's in office. So you just reiterate, just state openly that any incursion on the Baltic states will result in war with Russia. Just a fact. Just put it out there. I would like Obama to just say, you know what, you can have them. I don't want to start World War III over fucking Estonia.
I mean,
maybe he shouldn't say that out loud, but if he's thinking anything other than that, I'm fucking terrified.
Looking at it from the big boy side, he's the first Polish guy in centuries who's been able to say things like that to Russia. And,
I'm a Polish American, so I could say that. But I just also want to put this into context. I kid because I love, and I hate on this militarization of human rights because I think human rights institutions do a lot of great things. I think Human Rights Watch does a lot of terrific things. They have a lot of smart, talented people working for them, doing really courageous investigations and reports that make a big difference. You know, whether it's about the way migrant workers are treated in the Persian Gulf countries, whether, you know, our own human rights abuses here, whether that in Arkansas, if you get behind in your rent, your landlord could just have you thrown in jail as committing robbery. And Human Rights Watch did a report of that criminalization of not being able to pay your rent. And they do so much good work. But they really need to fucking cool it when it comes to recommending war. And Ken El Machete Roth, really, he's been there for 23 years now. He's got to step down. Maybe he can go on tour of Colombian provinces like, I don't know, Chocó on the Pacific coast or Baupés on the Brazilian border, the Caribbean coastal province of Chalán. These are all places that voted in favor of the peace deal against Ken Roth's judgment. Maybe he can explain to them why they were wrong to vote in favor of peace. Sure, they've been ravaged by this 52-year civil war with guerrillas, but maybe Ken Roth can step down from Human Rights Watch and just tell them where their legal judgment is lacking.
I think that's a good place to wrap up this conversation. Ken Roth, retire, bitch.
El Machete.
Chase Madar, thanks so much for talking to us.
Hey, thank you for having me at your trap home.
We are back now. Like I said, this is Chapo. All the Drive Boys are in the room together with a member of the media coming to you live from my apartment. And we're playing it up for the media because we figured if someone was going to sit on our recording sesh, we wanted to do it in an apartment where that is not caked in sawdust and cat vomit.
Yeah, so not my place.
Yeah, you're allowed to laugh. But yeah, no, Colette asked me when she came in, is this where we normally record? And I said, no, it is not.
Hell no. We are usually in my apartment, which is on the top of the Empire State Building in the Anthony Akumia Studios.
Yeah, we just so happened to take her to a room filled with books, which give the impression that we know how to read.
These are all my girlfriend's books, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Classic PSYOP.
Yeah, I've totally read all of these, not just Mein Kampf and Akira, my two favorite books.
The only thing on this wall that I've read is the literature known as The Motherfucking Wire on DVD. Hell yeah, bitch.
And I'd like to just say that I'm here from Baltimore. I'm here in the Big Apple. I'm walking here. And I'm from Baltimore.
The Wire.
Best Ricky Balmer and Mort Merriman, man.
My life is just like The Wire.
Got that pandemic.
My favorite thing about The Wire, and I know this because I'm also a member of the media, is how realistic it is. Like, right, I know what it's really like out there.
Having gone to Swarthmore, I can tell you what it's like to sling on the streets of Baltimore.
When I saw,
or Bodymore, Murderland, as we call it.
Dude, in the murder capital where we murder for capital, at Bard, where I went to school.
No, I mean, like I said, our interview with Chase this week, that was the vegetables. Vegetables roasted in duck fat is like, I like to imagine, our more intelligent and informative conversations. But now, let's talk about the election, because, you know, we don't have that much more time to talk about this election.
No, we don't.
Like, which the truly sand saddens is, me, by the way.
It does. It really does.
Every media dork who goes, ugh, this election just end already. I wish I could go into a coma and wake up on November 9th. Fuck you. This is amazing. I wish it happened forever. I wish it never ended. I wish they suspended the election and then, like, just for a year and said, we're going to do this
again
November 8th, 2017. That would be better for me.
It's the best election of my life.
The best election
and
ever.
All these media dorks who are like, this is like Game of Thrones, the Battle of the Dumpster Fire. actually, it fucking rules. And I don't want to talk about entitlement reform or ways to cut earmarks. Like, this shit bangs, and I want it.
Yeah, can you imagine after Hillary gets in and we're having to talk about, like, the fucking reconciliation process? Ugh. Gotta fucking put my head in a garbage disposal at the thought of that.
Yeah. Now, fucking entitlement reform and fiscal responsibility and jobs. Let's talk about Trump grabbing some motherfucking pussies.
The pussy grabbers have logged in.
Before we start, dear women, I just want to let you know that all guys do not talk like Trump. As somebody who has cleaned his assholes, balls, and taint in a locker room, dried them off with the dryer, and looked at old men putting the nozzle of the dryer up their asshole. This is not locker room talk. And if you need somebody to talk to in this time, one of the good guys, triple parentheses, Felix Biederman, open DMs.
You know, this
I know I can speak for myself, and I know I can speak for Matt. We've never talked like that because we've never been
exactly
in the locker
room. That's what
room.
I was going to ask. You actually could, because, and this is true of all of these pencil neck dorks who are like, I never heard that in the life. Yeah, it's because you were hiding in your locker in the locker room, afraid of getting fucking like a red ass with a like a rolled up towel.
One of the best things I saw today was, you know, this guy, Iowa Hawk.
Oh yeah, baby.
Hell yeah! He's got like several hundred thousand followers.
He's like a never Trump nerdlinger.
Yeah. He's a man who John Podoritz has dinged as the funniest voice on Twitter.
Glowing reviews,
no doubt.
He had something today. He was like, "I just got done with a road trip that covered 2,000 miles with my friends. Who's like, one's an auto mechanic and the other takes naked pictures of people for a living. if you recorded our conversations on the entire trip and played it to our mothers, like, we wouldn't be ashamed. And I was like, wow, that sounds like a fucking awesome car ride.
I would love to go on a road trip with Iowa Hawk Blog and fucking Terry Richardson. That sounds great.
How do they not drive into a fucking pylon? Jesus
Christ. Oh my
Christ.
99 bottles of beer on the wall.
99 bottles of ginger beer. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Ugh. Okay. I mean,
I would rather drive a fucking oil convoy from Raqqa than be on that road trip.
Seriously,
holy
so
fuck.
we Will and I, being soft, no, non-gym going boys, we don't even know really remember what it's like to be in a
dirty
salt.
I've been
room.
Exercising lately, and I just think reprehensible things to myself as I'm running because I hate it so much.
Yeah. Running sucks. Running's for pussies. It's not real exercise.
That's why I do it.
But I will. None of our listeners have ever been in a locker room. I'm one of the only people online who's ever been in one.
That's true.
So I'm going to start with my experiences. First time in the locker room. We're going with age 8, YMCA football team that I got onto because I told the coach about a play that Eric Dickerson made. Guy tossed me a towel. I caught it. And I was like, I should be a receiver because I caught it. Don't remember anything I said. Repeat this like 1,000 times until age 25 when I am in my first locker room in New York. It is September 2015. I am 25. I am making $1,500 a month. I sleep on a single mattress on the floor. Old Polish man with his balls out tells me about 9/11 truth. No, these conversations do not happen in the locker room. Ladies... This has been my locker room experience.
Women, I just do not believe that this is how men... We need to denormalize the idea that all men are gross bastards.
Yeah, yeah.
Gross podcast bastards.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is the October surprise, people. Yep.
All those InfoWars dorks waiting for Julian Assange to prove that Hillary Clinton personally did Benghazi... Like, yeah. She was, like, had a headset on, like, she was gaming and, like, ordering in, like, the militias to kill the guys, and they have the audio of that, and instead, it's...
Motherfucking
Trump's
Access Hollywood, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Fucking Bush. They thought it would be Hillary, like, the Marine commanders, like, but, Sister Hillary, the ambassador is gonna die, and she's like, what difference does it make? That was gonna be it, but no, it was just Trump, Trump, like, I take these bitches furniture shopping.
And I love how they're frustrated. The dorks are like, but the Podesta leaks. It's like, yeah, no one cares.
No one
cares about these guys going like, oh, we're going to have to create tranches of different millennials to micro target towards. It's like, yeah, he said he grabs pussies without permission.
It's like everything that we already knew about the Podesta group, that they're just incompetent nerd fucks, and everything we knew about Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, I think, the most important thing about Pussygate, pussy grabbing gate, is that, like, the thing I hate about it is it gives all these assholes an excuse to be like, no more. This is beneath the dignity of the White House. Like, what the fuck did you think this guy was about before?
That happened. That happened, earlier that day, not recorded with Billy Bush without his knowledge, in front of an audience. He said that the Central Park 5 kids who he had called to be executed and who were since exonerated with DNA evidence are probably guilty. They're like totally incapable of like admitting any kind of fault or mistake on his own part and slandering these kids whose lives were ruined by the NYPD.
Doubling down on his demand that 5 innocent teenagers be executed, basically.
Like, that's one of the vilest things he said in this whole fucking campaign. And that wasn't going to get any of these dorks to decide that it was a bridge too far.
And I hate the fact that this gives like a fig leaf to our elevator friends to not do what comes naturally to them, which is just bend the knee,
submit,
and, submit.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's been like a merry-go-round of hilarious reactions to this. So I mean, we could go through a couple. The first and most nauseating are people like Condoleezza Rice coming out today. Who personally oversaw the torture of POWs, being like, no, I cannot countenance this. Yeah, and then I guess the other avenue of hilarity that this has produced from the other side are, as we've alluded to before, like guys addressing every woman in the world on behalf of every man in the world, and just like the kind of wokeness pays off again. What can I say? Every time.
There's one very woke guy.
One of the wokest men on the planet. A man who's devoted his life to seeing gender representation in comic book movies, which is the noblest pursuit you can do.
Can you touch with all the fingers of Farachi? Can you review with the powers of the Hulk? Our old friend
Devin Farachi popped up today and got one of the worst, turnarounds I've ever seen online. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Pretty bad. He basically was just, you know, condemning Trump and being like, how could this happen? And some woman just replied to him, basically said, do you remember when you grabbed my pussy in a bar in front of, and then like smelled your fingers in front of everyone?
Wah, wah, wah.
And his reply to that was like, no, but I beg forgiveness anyway. Another, what a fucking asshole. And I was just telling Felix before you got here, I checked his timeline to see like his last tweet before all this happened. And it was, wow, Penny Dreadful really creates its own canon starting around episode 6. Great stuff, everybody. And I just love thinking about that as like the last moment before it all came crashing down.
Last thought. You know, it's like how Alan Moore says, like, our best and worst moments are actually live in eternity. And if he could just live in that moment before it all comes crashing down.
When he was enjoying his stories.
Yeah. Oh, Devin.
Devin.
Do better, Devin.
Okay, hilarious reaction number two comes from our girl, Molly Hemingway.
Woo! Woo.
Who said...
Keys quote, open doors.
Who said, quote, who knew it took a Trump to make the left turn so conservative about sex?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to, like, I've thought about this for a day now, and I really don't understand the hypocrisy she's trying to point out.
Well, because for these people whose brains have been broken by religious fanaticism... sexuality is just this giant pulsating sack of evil. It's undifferentiated. Grabbing a crotch without consent is the same as having like fornication. They're the same thing. And so like anybody who says some perversion and, you know, fornication is okay can never draw a line. There's
right.
No line.
Right. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, not to get back into this territory, but, you know, if you have this, like, sin-based view of sexual morality where, you know, PNV, married intercourse for the purpose of procreation, is, like, the only non-sinful form of sexuality, then it sort of flattens the difference between everything else in human existence.
And they do
existence.
That all the time. Like, this is just the latest iteration. Tons of them have always, like, whenever they're talking about, oh, you think that gay marriage is okay, but you don't like pedophilia? Like, they say that all the time. And that's why I really hope these guys do take over, and then, like, they have a fucking fleet of drones at their disposal to blow up, like, you know, porn stores or whatever. That's going to be awesome.
Well, I mean,
Max Hardcore has been killed in a drone store.
His number two has taken power.
I did see some reactions that like seem to be thinking that like the outrage is coming from the fact that Donald Trump said the word pussy.
Yeah, see, that's not it, lady.
Yeah. I love that.
I mean, it is kind of, it's astounding and hilarious to have actual audio of a presidential candidate a month away from the election saying pussy. It's a thing you couldn't imagine happening even a year ago.
No, definitely not.
So like, there's that kind of novelty and shock to it. But the horror comes from him admitting that he just grabs random women's vaginas without permission.
Like, you see where their priorities are, because what's the worst thing about the tape? The bad thing he said, not the truth of his actions that he revealed. So they're like, well, by your logic, the news outlets showing the video are no better than Donald Trump.
And that's where you get the other related insane take, which is, oh, so you guys who have ever listened to rap music, you're all hypocrites.
Okay, well, here's the other thing. Tonight is the second presidential debate.
Hell yeah, bitch.
Yeah, it's the second presidential
debate.
This
is going to be spicy.
Real debating hours. It's going to be spicy as hell.
Smash that fucking dropped up. Trickle down. Button.
Okay, here's my question. Like, it's going down tonight. You're probably going to be listening to this after the debate came out, but like, okay, in the first 5 minutes of the debate, you know Hillary is going to have one pre-prepared line, like in the first one where she was like, that sounds like trumped up economics.
Trumped up, trickle down, which of course took the nation by storm. Everyone's been saying it. It's on T-shirts. There's a movie coming out with that title starring Cameron Diaz. I'm looking forward to it.
I have it tattooed on the small of my back.
So what's going to be like... you know, Hillary's got this dynamite just sitting in her back pocket. And, like, what's going to be her prepared line?
I think it is a NatSec debate. So
yeah, it's a NatSec question.
She's going to be, like, talking about Putin because it's the woke Cold War. So she's going to go, when we negotiate with Putin, we know that he's not just going to let us kiss him because we're a star.
I promise that when I'm enforcing the Iran agreement, I won't be buying the Supreme Leader furniture.
No, yeah. Okay, so yeah, it's the NatSec debate tonight, and it's like Anderson Cooper, Martha Raddatz, and it's a fucking town hall.
Oh yeah.
So what a nightmare.
I love it when the cornpone morons of the United States of America who haven't even figured out who they're voting for yet are going to ask questions about national security and foreign policy. That's some smart shit.
Can you wait for when, like, fucking Jasper Pudd, wearing his overalls, chewing on a piece of straw, like, asks Trump about ISIS, and he just starts screaming at him about Juanita Broderick? It's going to fucking rule. If there is ever a debate where you're going to drink lean, like, this is the one.
Look, Mr. Trump, I heard what you talked about where you said you was going to grab them girls by the pussy. Can you promise right now that you're going to grab ISIS by the pussy?
No, I mean, several of the audience members are some Shia Yemenis who have just come back from a wedding.
Another thing, yeah, did happen this weekend. not as big as the Access Hollywood tape or anything else, but the Saudi coalition to restore democracy to Yemen did hit a triple tap airstrike in Sana'a, Yemen, meaning that they hit one target, hit the cleanup for the target, and then hit the mass funeral, killing, the reported total is 140, probably in excess of 500. With planes that we sold them and we refueled them. You guys think it's going to come up?
Definitely not. No, it's just boring. Yeah, Let's talk about Trump again.
No. ISIS will be talked about a shit ton, obviously.
Yeah.
And what to do about Assad and all that shit. But yeah, no, Yemen will not be discussed.
Not the country that gave Hillary's foundation that gives Uber to Ethiopians $25 million and just committed a flagrant war crime with our planes. Not going to come up.
No, they're good guys.
Yeah.
They're reformers with results. We read about that.
Our man, Dennis Ross. Yeah.
Like I said, so we're basically a month out from the election now. And obviously, if we take for granted now that Hillary Clinton is going to be president.
Oh, hell yeah. I'm ready.
The Podesta emails are probably more important because it gives a glimpse of how she actually will govern. And, you know, everything Bernie Sanders said about her in the primary is 100% true.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
everything about, like, what she was saying to Wall Street and then saying to the public is, you know, now just a matter of public record. But I want to say the other funny thing about the Access Hollywood tape is it should be like the final nail in the coffin of this idea that, well, Bernie Sanders certainly polled well against Trump, but in a general election, he would have been ripped apart. Yeah.
They could have fucking dug up Eugene Debs and fucking shot some electricity through him and he would have gotten elected. But instead, we went with hedge fund McRegime change. Yeah,
Bob,
it's awesome.
Bob Avakian would be up by 20 in Virginia right now.
Oh, God. What a world we'd be living in.
A LaRoche Avakian ticket would just be crushing it right now.
Okay, well, now the other thing is that apparently we just saw today that someone says that, of course, MTC also has audio of Trump saying the N-word.
Least surprising.
Finally proof that he's racist. Finally. Jesus.
You know, it is, like, of course, the response to the understandable response to this thing from people who watched this in horror for the past year, anybody who's freaked out. And I was like, what the fuck took you so long, you idiots? Why was he not horrible before? But the thing is, it's actually really perfect and poetic because, like, if the fact that people are now responding to this sensational tape that's just like that, like, you know, doesn't really reflect any actual issues other than him being a complete piece of shit. It makes sense because that's how he got fucking nominated in the first place, by just being a sensational, like, thing that caught eyeballs and that idiots were like, ooh, I can listen to him talk. He's not boring like all those other politicians.
Well, I mean, that gets into the other thing that I've been seeing a lot of this week, even before the pussy tape dropped. Well, I saw, you know, our good friend the baseball crank and our other good friend Twitter user Comfortably Smug. And fucking Ross Douthat did the same thing. He's been like, they've been crafting this carefully, like saying that, like, basically, it's Democrats and liberals' fault that Trump has got this far because they've cried wolf too many times. And like Mitt Romney was a decent man. And that, you know, people said that he was waging a war on women. But and then Trump came along and all the people that voted for him just didn't know the difference. So like, I don't get. But it's like essentially the most craven thing imaginable is like, these are your people. This is your fucking party.
Yeah, exactly.
It's your fucking fault.
Okay, like, so you really think that your fucking idiot hayseed voters, these people who think that anything from a mainstream media source is directly dictated by Zog headquarters, you think they really took that war on women shit seriously? Do you think they took that in their heart for 4 years and then they're like, you know what? He was actually a good guy and they fooled me. Fool me once, liberal media. No. Nobody listens. That's the whole fucking point about the current media environment is that nobody who has a committed political position listens to anything that is against it. So all that war on women shit did, that was just stuff to rally Democrats. It had no impact on Republican voters, who are the ones who fucking nominated Trump.
And, you know, Brendan pointed this out. Fucking Ezra Klein today was just like, the dominoes are all falling for Trump. The people that really matter, Condi Rice, John McCain. And it's just like, dude, these people don't matter at all.
No one gives a shit about any of these fucking assholes.
These people live in a complete fucking bubble.
For the average Trump voter, every single person in Washington is on the same fucking team against them. And they have no loyalty to them. They have no sense that they... like have to listen to
and
anything
like,
they say.
And fucking Condi Rice. And like, worst of all, fucking now Mike Pence, who's a fucking ghoul.
A fucking comically evil.
He's beside himself about Trump's comments about women. And like, you know, these guys who like, he shut down Planned Parenthood in Indiana and like, and then put all the money into gay conversion therapy. And then like, 250 people got HIV that would have otherwise been prevented from happening.
Mike Pence would never sexually assault a woman, then allow her to get an abortion. That's the difference between him and Trump.
But yeah, I mean, like, Pence is like, he's like one of those really broadly drawn bad guys from like an 80s movie that's supposed to satirize Reaganism. I mean, he's that guy, only like his skull is like showing through his skin. But he's now a good dude because he's horrified by what Trump said.
But he's still going to stay on the ticket.
Oh, yeah. And he's got the, and that gives him the inside track in 2020 because he'll be able to straddle the line because he was like on the ticket, which said kind of makes some of the Trump people give him the benefit of the doubt. But then he also was appalled by the horrible stuff. So, like, all the fucking lanyard dicks will like him too.
All you have to be to earn any respect to these people is to be appalled by something.
Yeah.
When it has
something,
no,
and yeah, and of course, nothing that has to do with policy. Nothing that actually kills people.
And you don't actually have to do anything, as Mike Pence isn't.
I have to say, though, that my favorite thing about this is the guys who now are caught out, like the Trump loyalists, you know, like the bunker guys. who are now like going down with the ship, and like Giuliani, like
what a fitting end,
man.
Like,
Giuliani's stipulation, obviously Giuliani is the biggest piece of shit on earth, always was from the day he was born.
Fucking
just a kernel of
scum,
of ass, just a scumbag his entire life. But after 9/11, he was America's mayor. Like, he really was. He was probably like one of our most well-respected public figures, undeservedly, but he was for a solid like decade. And now, thanks to being on, like, getting on Trump's because he thought he was going to be attorney general or something, he goes on TV and he gets fucking owned by Chuck Todd, who is a glob of margarine with a goatee stuck on it. That is like the most Shakespearean fall from grace I can imagine.
It's like Darth Vader tripping over banana peel and falling down the energy shaft.
I'm not looking forward to November and, like, you know, the next at least 4 years of a Hillary Clinton presidency. But
I am really looking
forward to all the people who really think that, like, Trump is going to win.
That's going
like,
to be
who
funny.
Really have convinced themselves that,
yeah,
like,
that,
he's going to win in a landslide.
Patrick Warburton guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Ricky Vaughn.
R.I.P.
I hope he comes back.
Me too.
Come on, Twitter. You have to unban
Ricky
Vaughn
back
before
just
before
November.
Hey, Twitter. Ban Devin Faraci.
Yes.
Bring back Ricky Vaughn.
Yeah, no, that's going to be fun. We have a lot to look forward to in the future. I can't wait till all the neocons stab Hillary in the back the first chance they get in like February.
And right. They all join the Tom Cotton Exploratory Committee.
Yeah, just completely fuck her over. Kagans, all of them.
I can't wait for Hillary to announce Treasury Secretary nominee Erskine Bowles. That's going to be awesome.
The first Saudi quadruple tap in Yemen. There's a lot to look forward to.
Well, as I said earlier today, at least like the Trump supporters, like, you know, the 27% sort of rump of you know, basically
deplorables people.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah, I think that's an accurate way of putting it. Like people that
that's
in civilized
the beltway
society
for piece
would
of
be,
shit, which would have been more accurate,
would be,
and would have been funnier because then they all would have been like on Twitter, been like piece of shit Steve, yeah. And they would have gone to rallies with shirts saying I'm a proud piece of shit.
I am dunking myself in my septic tank to own Hillary.
They totally would have done that too. They would have had a hashtag, a bunch of guys bubbling around and turds like hanging in their hair.
Hey, Hillary.
Take that, Hillary. I'm going to eat one just to show you.
Oh, my God. I saw this earlier today. I suppose I never like talking about him on the show because he is such a boring attention whore, but did you see that thing where Milo got in a bath of pig's blood to own immigrants, I think?
Got him, bitch.
So it's like they had an art show in Williamsburg with like him and Gavin McGinnis and like James O'Keefe. And it was,
are they finally going to fuck to own Islam? I know they kissed to own Islam. Yeah. What are they going to fuck to own Islam?
Hey, mullahs in Iran. I have AIDS now. What do you say to that?
Hey, is like drowning yourself haram? Because maybe we could like convince them it is.
I just sucked
sure
a dog's dick because it's in the Quran. Fuck you.
No, but he's like the pig's blood represents all the people that have been killed by Muslims and immigrants.
Okay.
Got him.
But wait a minute. He's the one in the bath.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Brilliant.
So yeah, like I said, Trump is going to become like the Avignon Pope for like the most repellent shitheads America's capable of producing.
Oh yeah.
And Hillary will be the Borgia.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. And we are Eastern Orthodox.
I do hope that he does do the TV network thing. That he like does the thing that they have been talking about him like setting up.
That would be awesome.
So? Who else is going to give us a contract?
That's not going to happen, Brendan.
So I read about this for The Guardian, and I would love it too. But my sense is that he doesn't have the vision or the patience.
No, he's a lazy, dumb shithead.
And when you look at the right wingers who have tried to do that in the aftermath of either a candidacy or some venture that got them really famous and got their profile up, you have from least influential to probably most, you have Herman Cain, started Cain TV. That
I
died.
Forgot about Cain
and then
TV.
It came back and it still sucked. And then you have Sarah Palin channel. Like 100,000 people watched it each month. There wasn't enough.
Oh, that was the one that was like a subscription based over the internet.
They stopped doing subscriptions. They were not even close to the 23rd Patreon of all time, like we are. Couldn't even get
take that. Take that, Palin.
And then
we can buy all the snow machines we want, motherfuckers.
Exactly. And then there was Glenn Beck. And I think
the Blaze TV is still on my cable package.
Yeah,
okay?
but for now. But if anyone could, I think, successfully create a new media presence for pissed off alt conservatives that, you know, didn't want the establishment gumming up their, you know, the airwaves anymore, I think it would be Beck. And the Blaze is just, you know, degenerating year after year. And they're just laid like 40 people off. He's closing all of his studios one by one.
Yeah, but Beck's
one.
A cuck.
Yeah, he is now. But Trump will be a cuck in a couple of years. Like
his
fans
I would agree if it was up to Trump to set it up, it would never happen because, as we said, he's a lazy idiot.
Yeah.
But Ailes is probably going to be on his team because he's canned now from Fox News.
Possibly.
He's not an idiot. He's a piece of shit, obviously. But he's not just a lazy, spoiled toddler. Well, that's true. He could die.
Also, Roger Ailes is also very good at assaulting women.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Perfect ticket.
Can you imagine? I mean, like him talking to Billy Bush was gross. Can you imagine when him and Giuliani and Christie?
Oh my God!
And fucking Ailes are talking.
If you could listen to a recording of that, it would sound like the made-up language H.P. Lovecraft does in the Call of Cthulhu. It would just be like it would be indecipherable. It would like it would cause madness.
Yeah, you would be instantly driven insane by hearing a syllable of it.
Going back to the TV network though, there is one person on Trump's team who I think makes this a shoo-in. Who makes this is going to work.
Is that
who is better for a visionary TV network than a man who cannot technically see? Carson TV, bitch.
That would be the Blaze TV meets Tim and Eric, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like the people would be like, this is the greatest alt comedy thing I've ever seen. Yeah. Like just 4 hours of Carson rambling on TV.
It's like if Steve Brule wouldn't shut up about the Bible.
The career. Go into the light until we meet again. That's what the Carillions say. Salome. Brendan, how long have you been recording?
About half an hour.
Half an hour?
Yeah.
Salome.
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 Till next time, guys.
Peace.
Colette, say goodbye.
Assalamu alaikum.
Bye.
You're indicted now.
Rico, baby.
I've never said I'm a perfect person, nor pretended to be someone that I'm not. I've said and done things I regret, and the words released today on this more than a decade-old video are one of them. Anyone who knows me knows these words don't reflect who I am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize. I've traveled the country talking about change for America, but my travels have also changed me. I've spent time with grieving mothers who've lost their children, laid off workers whose jobs have gone to other countries, and people from all walks of life who just want a better future. I have gotten to know the great people of our country, and I've been humbled by the faith they placed in me. I pledge to be a better man tomorrow and will never, ever let you down. Let's be honest, we're living in the real world. This is nothing more than a distraction from the important issues we're facing today. We are losing our jobs. We're less safe than we were 8 years ago. And Washington is totally broken. Hillary Clinton and her kind have run our country into the ground. I've said some foolish things, but there's a big difference between the words and actions of other people. Bill Clinton has actually abused women, and Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims.